some while ago, I guess it was a little over a year ago, one evening I attended an affair at Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, and the guest that evening was George Balzer. And he put on one of the finer presentations that I've had the pleasure of attending, and so immediately I wanted him for one of our meetings, and so I contacted him, and finally our schedules worked out so that we're able to have him. And I'll just say George Balzer was one of the writers of one of my favorite shows, and I'm sure one of the favorite shows of a lot of the rest of you. And so I'd like for you to give a warm, spurred back welcome to George Balzer, a writer of The Jack Benny Show.
Set here, I guess. Thank you very much. It's certainly a delight for me to be here, to have been asked to be here on this occasion. I arrived rather early, about a half hour early, but when you come from a great distance, you have to allow for car troubles and so forth. And I do live about a mile and a half away. So anyway, I thought maybe on this occasion, since the audience is made up of people who are interested and have a hobby-like approach to old radio, that maybe we'll just keep it on more of an informal informal framework, even to the point of questions, if you wish, make a mental note of them, and we can stop most any time and answer. And we'll just kind of keep it freewheeling in that way. But to get things underway, I'd like to take you back to a Sunday evening when my wife and I had just sat down to listen to a Jack Benny radio show. Since I was one of his writers, I had heard that phrase, "Hello again, this is Jack Benny talking," 1,000 times, but never had it had the impact as it had on me and on this particular evening. For you see, this was not a Sunday evening in the 1930s or 40s. It was Sunday evening, December 29th, 1974, and only a few short hours earlier, my wife and I had returned from Hillside Cemetery, where we said our last goodbye to Jack Benny. When I heard his voice say hello again, it gave me an eerie feeling that some way, somehow, he had followed us home. The recording I picked at random was a radio show that was broadcast from Palm Springs on February 11th, 1951, 3 days before Jack's birthday. And we will listen to a little more of that.
And why not? Every day I lay out beside the pool at the beautiful Palm Springs Biltmore Hotel. It's the most exclusive...
Wait a minute, Jack. I don't like to correct
your friends, but it isn't lay by the fool, it's lie. Well, John, in this case, you're both right. You see, I don't live at the village. If I lay by the fool, I have to lie to the light. I really got him fooled, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, I borrowed a bathing suit from Mary, and he thinks I'm Esther Williams.
Jack, you mean to say that you wore Mary's 2-piece bathing suit?
Uh-huh. I'm going to have a hard time explaining my tan to the boys in the field. Anyway, change the subject, John. Did you get the invitation I sent you to my birthday party next Wednesday?
Oh, yes, Jack, and there's something in it I don't quite understand.
What's that?
Well, it says, you are cordially invited to attend my birthday party on Wednesday, February 14th. And down in the corner it says 15-9-34. What do those numbers mean?
They're the sizes of my shirt, slippers, and underwear. See, I used to put RSVP and I got nothing. I'm not taking it. Oh, hello, Mary.
Hello, Jack. Hi, everybody.
Four days and you're darker than I am.
Well, Jack, I should be. I'm out in the sun from morning till night. I walk all the time.
See, I didn't know you were so energetic.
Who's energetic? I can't find a room.
It is awfully crowded down here, isn't it?
You're not kidding. Yesterday I put a penny in a gum machine, full of leather, and a woman stuck his head out and said, sorry, no bacon, please.
It went on, of course, to the entrance of Phil Harris, Dennis Day, phone call, I guess, from Rochester, and then a sketch. And when it was over, I had a sense of personal pride because I had been a writer for Jack Benny for some 25 years. I guess at this point I'd like to tell you now a little bit about myself, feeling that because of your interest in old radio, you may have an interest in some of those people behind the scenes. Strangely enough, I think I was, if not the one, or the only one, I was one of the few who broke the myth that comedy writers must come from New York, specifically Brooklyn. That was a belief in the business. And that is not my story. I was born in Erie, Pennsylvania. I moved west. At the time, of course, when my family moved west, my father and mother, brothers and sisters, and we settled in the southwest part of Los Angeles in an area of Manchester and Broadway. After living there for 6 years, we moved out into the San Fernando Valley, and that was in 1926. I went to grammar school and high school here in the valley. And developed an interest after listening to much radio and felt that I could write that kind of material. And I gave it a try and started taking my scripts around to wherever I could just to be looked at. And strangely enough, the show that I felt I could write, a show that I had listened to on radio every week, was the Jack Benny Show. So I wrote these scripts, five versions of what I thought a Benny script would be like. And fate, of course, always has something to do with our success. It's the contacts you make, and there's always someone else that gives you a little boost along the way. And in my case, again, as I say, it was fate. A man by the name of Divine, Tom Divine, moved in just behind our family residence. And it turns out that Tom was a brother of Vandy Divine. And, of course, when I heard that, it was at the time that Andy Devine was on the Jack Benny Show. I made it a point to talk to Andy. I asked him about the business, and he encouraged me, read a few of my scripts, and said, I think you have something here, and I'll help you if I can. And it wasn't too long before I got a call from a Young and Rubicam advertising agency, which asked me to come in for a short meeting. I went in, and they talked to me for just a short while, and I explained to them that up to that point, I had never been inside a radio studio. I had no idea what a studio was like. So it was the head of the agency, Tom Harrington, that was speaking to me, and he said, well, how would you like to come to one of the Jack Benny shows? I said, gee, that would be wonderful. So he picked up the phone and he called his girl and said, would you get me two tickets for the Benny Show Sunday evening? And there was a little pause and he hung up the phone and he said, there are no more. So from the heights, I went to the depths of disappointment. He said, however, if you will come to the artist entrance and ask for me, they will bring you back stage. So the first time that I was ever in a radio studio was in the control room of the Jack Benny Show. So that's the point I try to make. It's those breaks and the little help you get along the way, and fantastic things happen. After that experience, nothing much took place. I continued to make contacts. There was no opening on the Benny Show because Jack had his staff. And I did make a contact that got me a job writing for a writer. I wrote for a writer named Duke Atterbury, who wrote, and I don't know how many of you will remember this, the Bob Burns spot on the old Bing Crosby Craft Music Hall. Well, literally, I used to work up in Duke's attic. That's where he had all his files and all that, and my job was to sit there all day long and just write jokes. And I would kind of go down, sneak downstairs and slide them under Duke's bedroom door, and he would take them and read them, mark off the ones he wanted, and then a secretary would put them on cards and he would file them away. After a few weeks, the Bob Burns spot was made up of about 12 jokes. That was the whole thing. Now, this was the fellow who played the bazooka, as you'll remember. I'm sure you fellas don't remember. But eventually I had a joke on the show. Then I had two. Then I would have three of the 12, seven of the 12, eight, maybe back to six. And then a day came when I had all 12, the whole spot. Now, I was making at that time $20 a week. I'm not certain, but I had heard that Duke was making $1,200. I was afraid to pursue that. But I did because of a need. I needed an extra $5 because I had no car. I was using my brother's car to drive back and forth to work. I went down, I said, Duke, do you think you could give me $5 more a week? And he fired me. So, again, we're downhill. Then after that, I met another writer. As a matter of fact, I'd met the writer, Marvin Fisher, earlier, and he was the one who steered me on to Duke, which I appreciated. Then I met Marv again, and he said, well, why don't you join me? He was doing the Signal Carnival, which was not a local show, but a West Coast show, played in 11 Western states, sponsored by Signal Oil Company. Vera Vague was on it, Jack Carson. And I was there about 3 months, I believe, when I got a call from the agency, the same people who some 2 years earlier had talked to me about the Benny Show and my Benny scripts. And I went up to the agency and they said, we're starting a new Burns and Allen show with a new approach in which George and Gracie will now be man and wife instead of just a vaudeville team. I don't know whether you can recall those days or not. We were on for Swan Soap. So they then hired me to work with Burns and Allen. After 39 weeks, the Burns and Allen show went off the air, and there was a summer replacement show. Tommy Riggs and Betty Lou. That's another one to try and remember. So Sam Perrin, my partner, whom I met on the Burns and Allen show, we moved over to do the summer replacement. The deal was that after 13 weeks, we go back to Burns and Allen. Burns and Allen come back on the air and continue. After 9 weeks, the sponsor felt that the summer replacement had a high enough rating to keep on the show all the time. So what happened is we took a 13-week show and we ran it into 65 weeks. On the 63rd week is when I got the call to join Jack Benny, which I did not turn down. And I had to go to New York to meet Jack. Now this is what's happening to a country boy who remembers Balboa Boulevard, I think before it was paved, Ventura Boulevard, just a narrow strip of asphalt, cornfields and so forth all around here. I now get my first trip on a train since 1920. I've never been back on a train. And in real class, on the Chief. So we get to New York, and it was on the train that I met Milt Josephsberg, who was also joining the show at that time. And of course, we talked about a lot of things. We talked about Bill Morrow and Ed Boulogne, who were Jack's previous writers. And I learned then that Bill was quite a drinker. So much so, in fact, that when he traveled with the Benny Show, he would fill his cases full of bourbon and carry his clothes over his arm, the suit, the suit and the shirts and the ties and socks he had in his arm, and in the case he had the bottles. Now, that sounds kind of strange, but that makes a lot of sense. I mean, when you're in a state where you might fall down any minute, it's better to fall on an armload of clothes than an armload of bottles. But anyway, Bill had been drafted into the Army and had to leave the show, but a wonderful fella. Everybody was Bill's friend. But also learned on the train that... Well, Milt was also addicted to the bottle at that time, and still is, but not whiskey. Milt is addicted to ketchup. He will quit ketchup on anything. I will tell you, I've been with him, he order ice cream and make a ketchup sundae out of it. But it was on this trip when we were talking about the fact that Milt lived in Brooklyn, and to him, this was going home. And there was kind of a twinkle in his eye, and I thought that was rather nice, that a man should have a sentimental feeling about going home. And then I found out that it wasn't sentiment, it was just that he knew he would be living at his mother's house and putting the expense money in his pocket. So we did arrive in New York, we got off the train, and I went to the Warwick Hotel, and at about the same time I was checking into my room, Milt was checking into his mother's refrigerator. So for the first few days, we really didn't have much to do because Jack at that time, the reason we had to go to New York was because Jack was in North Africa with the USO, entertaining the armed forces, and he hadn't arrived back yet for the opening of the season, which we were going to do in New York. And I recall while Milt had gone to Brooklyn, I was in my hotel room now, all alone. And after a while, strange city, I felt a little lonesome. So I picked up the phone, I called the desk clerk, and I told him what was on my mind, and he says, yeah. He says, you go up to the 15th floor, gave me a room number. So I took his directions, I caught the elevator, went up, walked down the hall, and knocked on the door. It was a long pause, I knocked on the door again, and then suddenly the door opened, and there, standing in a very sheer dressing gown, was John Tackerberry. John was also joining the show, and I had never met him. And he explained to me that the reason he didn't answer the door immediately was because he had been in the shower. And from the puddles on the floor and his accent, I could tell that he was a wet Texan. And that takes care of three of us. Another writer at that time, whom we mentioned in the bulletin, was Cy Howard. Cy was not really a writer on the Benny Show. Now, to clarify that, he did join us at that time, but within the first few weeks, he was not comfortable with the way we worked, and I believe he had a chance to take a part in a play or something, and after about 4 or 5 weeks, he was gone. In later years, I had much success in doing pictures and so forth, but he was not really a writer on the Benny Show. So that takes care. There is myself, Milt, Tack, and of course my old partner Sam Perrin, whom I met on the on the Burns and Allen Show. The four of us. Sam didn't come to New York. Something detained him here on the coast, but he picked up with the show when we came home. But anyway, on October 10th, 1943, we went on the air with that opening Benny Show of that season. And fortunately, with all new writers, it got great reviews. Everybody was very happy. And then came time to prepare the second show. Now, if I may go back just a moment, before we did the first show, and to publicize Jack's returning from North Africa, the news people wanted to do a news conference with Jack, and there were at the Sherry Netherlands Hotel, and there was this bank of cameras, and they wanted to interview Jack and so forth. And Jack said to us, he said, I don't want to just do it straight. Can't we get some sort of a comedy gimmick that we can use and make it a little lighter and so forth and so on? So we all thought about it. And fortunately for me, I happened to come up with an idea that he used, an idea wherein it would take two or three reporters asking him questions. Well, as it turned out, there were only two reporters and we needed three. So Jack says, George, why don't you play one of the reporters? So I did, and a day or two later, why, I'm in newsreels all over the country. Another incident that happened, which I happened to, I went to St. Patrick's Cathedral on Sunday morning, and I'm sitting there minding my own business when an usher comes by. He puts a basket in my lap, and I don't know what to do with it, from that kind of operation anyway. And I see that's the way they do it there, where then you take it and you pass it on down, and you take it and you move it from pew to pew. And I'm doing this, and I look across the aisle, and I'm bumping elbows with Jim Farley. Now, I don't know if any of you, I'm sure the older folks will remember Jim Farley. He was the Postmaster General under President Roosevelt. And here we are, we're working back to back. So when you stop and think, now over a short period of time, from the time I got the call to join Jack, the great train trip to New York, newsreels all over the country, rubbing elbows with Jim Farley. It's just amazing what happens. Now, I only tell you this because though that kind of thing, we're all subject to that happening, and you never know when it's going to happen. So I was flying sky high, I'll tell you. So anyway, there's one more thing which I'll talk to you about. We've done our first show. We're very happy with it. Now it's time for the second show. And we get that all written, and we have an idea where Jack, because of his mingling with the military people, took on the stature within his own mind of being a general. So we did the show around that theme, in which he would be drilling his new writers. So we wrote it, and we said, now, Jack, who's going to play the writers? We'll have to cast these people. He says, you are. So he always believed that when you use real people, it always works better. And we did play the part. And we'll drop that number two tape in there now. And this is the spot that we did. At that time.
Hey, Mary, how's Jackson since he got home?
Oh, Phil, it's simply awful. Since he got back from North Africa, that's all he talks about. He absolutely drives him nuts. This military stuff has really gotten into Jack's system. God, how he'd love to be a general. What a guy. That's Jack now, up and all.
What you doing, Curly?
Either that or counting his hair. Who knows?
Say, Mary, do you think I ought to go out and get Jack away from his wife?
No, I'll go.
So that's the way it went, and I also had the pleasure and fun throughout the rest of the career of periodically, not too often, but periodically playing a part on the show. When we traveled and didn't take too many extra performers with us, the little extraneous part would come up. Why I had the fun, and as I say, the pleasure of doing it. I also learned in working with Jack that what we'd heard about him on the radio was that he really did have blue eyes. And many times since then I had the fun of writing lines to describe them, such as bluer than the feet of a Sicilian wine crusher, or bluer than the thumb of a cross-eyed carpenter. And then again, when the light would hit him just right, you could see that his eyes were bluer than the stomach of a dachshund that's been chased through a huckleberry patch. Working with Jack was an experience that should happen to every writer, because his relationship, and I think this was the secret, the whole story behind those many, many, many years of success. That was his respect for writers. And Jack has often said in interviews and has said on occasion to me, had said on occasion to me personally, where he said, I, meaning Jack Benny, come first because it's his show and he's the star. That he said with a twinkle in his eye, and then more seriously he followed with, then next to me come my four writers, and don't put anyone between me and my writers. Next to them come the director, shoeshine boy, parking lot attendant, producer, manager, but don't ever put anybody between me and my writers. Now, what he was trying to say is that when this show is finished, and when it's rehearsed, and when it goes on the air, it belongs to these five people, plus, of course, those performers. Nobody comes in between and says we think it should be done this way or that way. When we decided that that was the way it was to be done, that's the way it was done. An illustration to make that point stronger was, I remember one rehearsal at NBC at some point in our long career. After a rehearsal, a gentleman came up to Jack and said, "Mr. Benny, on page 6, and Jack turned to page 6, he says, "I think these two jokes should be cut." And Jack said, "Well, why?" And the man says, "Because I don't think, or rather, because they aren't funny. Because they aren't funny." And Jack said, "Now, wait a minute. Don't you ever say they aren't funny. You say you think they aren't funny." And that's just to illustrate the delicacy of comedy. No one really knows for sure and can say. So don't ever say that they aren't. You say you think they aren't. So the man said, "Well, all right, because I think they aren't funny." Jack said, "Now that's fine, I'll buy that. But unfortunately for you, my writers and I think they are funny and they're going to stay in." And they did. And both of them got very big laughs. So there's just a little point that he never let anyone come in between himself as a performer and those people who created for him. And that's rare. Today it's non-existent. When you finish a script and you turn it in, that is the end of that. And before they get through with it, if they're not too knowledgeable, you don't even recognize it when it comes back, when it comes out on the air or on the TV. Well, we'll move along here, and let's see what we can find about. Well, I'll tell you, in those days, of course, then we came back to the coast, and we used to do a lot of work at Jack's house in Beverly Hills. And we'd go over there for to work on the script with Jack after we had completed the rough. And my partner and I would work on it right here in the valley. Then we'd go over to Jack's house. I remember one morning we went over for a cleanup, and Jack came downstairs and he let us in. And as we came in the front, through the front door, he said, "Shh. Still sleeping." It's okay. So we tiptoed upstairs and down the hall. We closed the door. And it was then, for the first time, I learned that a star, no matter how big he is, can only twinkle in his own house. So we went into Jack's bedroom, and we're sitting there working, and we give Jack the script, and he's looking it over. He's in bed because he had a cold. So he gets back in under the covers, and he's up here, and he's reading the script, and he turns the pages. And on about the third page, the door opens. And Jack doesn't stop reading. He throws back the covers, gets out of bed, walks over to the door, closes it, walks back across the room, gets back into bed, pulls up the covers, doesn't stop reading. Another two pages, the door opens. Covers off, across the room, closes the door, doesn't stop reading, comes back in bed, pulls the covers. This happened about five times. And I was sitting close to the door, so I got up and I walked over to the door. I take out a little penknife that I have and a dime. I take out the little screw, two screws from the strike plate, and I take it off. I take the knife and I cut a little piece of wood off. I put this thing back, and Jack's still in bed. He didn't see me. And he's reading and he's reading, and after the third page, he looks up and the door doesn't open. He goes back to reading, reads some more. Door doesn't open. He reads some more. And he stopped and he says, "George, what in the hell did you do to that door?" And I explained to him what I did. And he says, "Well, how do you like that?" He said, "I paid $400,000 for this house. And for 6 years, every 4 minutes, I've been getting out of bed to close that door." Now, that's a true story. So I said, "Well, Jack, for heaven's sakes, why didn't you tell the butler, the handyman, or someone and have him fix it?" He says, "Oh, I don't know. I guess I just didn't want to bother anybody." And that really, for the first time, I realized that that is just the kind of a man he was. He just didn't want to bother anybody. And he never carried any ill will toward any. He always saw the bright side or the right side of things. He never really let himself get upset with people. And we used to play on this. I did a joke for him once on that basis, where he was doing a monologue talking to the audience. It happened to be Christmas Day that we had to be on the air. And he's doing the monologue, and he says, "Oh, I must tell you what happened to me this morning." He says, "I got up very early, and I tiptoed downstairs because I didn't want to awaken Rochester. And I ran over to the tree, and I picked up a present, and I sat there, and I started to open it, when I heard a knock on the door. So I went to the front door, and there was nobody there. But sitting on the porch was this beautiful gift. So I picked it up, I took it back in the house, sat down again, and just as I started to open it, it exploded. It says, blew in the roof, blew in the north wall, the east wall, the fireplace fell right into the room. The tree caught on fire. My robe was smoking." And he says, "My first impulse was to call the police. But then I happened to think that at Christmas time, it isn't the gift that counts, it's the spirit in which it is given." So that pretty much sums him up. Now, Mary, of course, we used her on the show. She was a regular. And yet, if you stop to think about it, she was kind of a utility player, in that we used Mary in various ways wherever we could. She was not Jack's girlfriend. Of course, in real life, she was Mrs. Jack Benny. But on the show, she wasn't his girlfriend. She was just a friend. If we had did a show where Jack had to go somewhere and needed a girl companion, Mary would serve that role. If Jack had a date with some girl and Mary would go along, then she was not the girlfriend. And Mary, of course, used to get those letters from Mama, which I'm sure you recall. Before I do that, however, let me get into a thing after that door routine I told you about, which showed Jack's real life lack of mechanical knowledge. We did a show, not a show, but a little spot in which we had fun with that because it was real. And this is the way that played.
Gentlemen, about 3 hours ago, Jack Benny left home for the studio. Rochester was driving him, and on the way they had a little tire trouble. So let's go back and find out what happened.
Now, how much longer before you'll have a spare on, Rochester?
Just a couple of minutes.
Couple of minutes. It would have been 6 long ago if I'd have done it myself.
Hand me the wrench, will you, boy?
The wrench? Here.
That's a screw gun.
Oh, the wrench. Here.
That's the pump.
Oh, here.
That's the rocket.
Oh, you want the wrench? The wrench.
You're back in the screw gun again.
What?
You know, boss, you just ain't mechanically minded.
I am too.
Then why do you call me every morning to screw the cap back on your toothpaste?
Look, just hurry with the tire, will you?
I'm almost finished.
Good. I just can't understand having a blowout. A very good tire. It's a general.
I know, but you throw this general down to a foot price.
Stop being silly. That tire hasn't got so many holes in it.
It hasn't. Or the inner tube could be arrested for indecent exposure.
What?
Even the wheel is ashamed to go around with it.
Rochester, that's a terrible joke. An awful joke. What are you laughing at?
You always say that, and 2 weeks later, it shows up on your program.
Does not. Now, come on, you're all through. Let's get going.
Now, as I pointed out, Mary was so well known for reading those letters from Mama. So we've got one here that we'd like to play for you. Give you, bring that back to memory.
Oh, hello, Mary.
Hello, Jack. Say, Jack, I got your message. What do you want to see me about?
I'll tell you when the rest of the gang get here. Why'd you come over so early, Mary?
Well, I got a letter from Mom, and I wanted to read it to you.
Oh, a letter from your mother? Well, what does the Lauren Bacall of Plainfield have?
February 30th.
Where
Quentin
only has 28 days.
I know, but Mama
doesn't
think it's fair. Go ahead, read it. My dear daughter, Mary, it certainly was exciting when you and Jack spent those few days with us on your trip east. It's too bad you had to dress in such a hurry that morning to catch the train.
We barely made it.
I didn't realize how much you had rushed until after you were gone. But don't worry, as I just mailed your toothbrush and Jack's hair. The one with the handle is the toothbrush.
No wonder I caught a cold in Chicago.
Now for a paragraph or two about your sister Bay.
Ah, good. This is the part I like.
Since the warm weather is here, your sister Babe got herself one of those new French bathing suits. She tried it on yesterday, and I haven't seen so much of Babe since the doctor said it's a girl. However, she's very happy with the suit. Next month, she's entering a swimming contest.
A contest? Gee, I didn't even know that she could swim.
Oh, sure, Jack. She's a regular mermaid.
Well, I've noticed the resemblance, except the wrong half looks like a fish. You're funnier than your mother. Continue with the letter, Mary.
Mary, dear, you'll be happy to know that Babe is also taking dancing lessons from Arthur Murphy.
What?
You got a swell deal, too. He teaches her dancing and she fixes his plumbing.
I knew she could do it.
And now in closing, Mary, I have some neighborhood gossip that will really surprise you. Guess who murdered his wife this morning? No other news, love, Mama.
Well, that's a fine way to end
it. Mary was also one to keep Jack in line. She would say things that really put him in his place when it was necessary. And we had an occasion where it fit very well, in that we had as a guest our Dorothy Kirsten, the singer, and Jack, of course, wanted to show off and get into a conversation that Dorothy and Don were having, and this is the way we had the build-up, and how were we going to pay it off? Just what could we say to make this whole thing come together? And I happened to think of a very short line that did it all. And it was the line we used. And it paid off very well. So we'll give it a shot here.
Hey, Jack, we better start rehearsing. It's on the air pretty soon.
Yeah, let's get going, Jack. The music's all right.
Good. And now, hey, wait a minute. Where's Don? Oh, Don.
Here I am, Jack.
Well, look, Don. We've got practically everything ready but the quartet. Did you rehearse them?
Oh, yes, Jack. I've got a great surprise for you.
A surprise?
Yes. For weeks now, your quartet's been rehearsing an operatic number, but they needed a soprano for the lead.
Uh-huh.
So I took the liberty of asking Miss Dorothy Kirsten to come over and join us.
Well, I think it was very... Dorothy Kirsten? You don't mean Dorothy Kirsten of the Metropolitan Opera?
Yes, Mr. Benny, and here I am.
To Dennis Day. Dennis, of course, was just that silly kid that used to drive Jack nuts just with crazy talk. And I remember such as one time he came into a rehearsal, supposedly we were doing on the air or whatever, and he was late. And so Jack says, Dennis, where were you? I'm sorry, Mr. Benny, but I was shopping and I got caught between floors. And Jack says, oh, imagine being caught between floors in an elevator. He says, no, I was on an escalator. So Jack says, well, for heaven's sake, Dennis, why didn't you walk either up or walk down? He says, well, that would be cheating. So Jack says, yeah, cheating. He says, you know, a lot of people did. So with that kind of crazy talk, another time we did a show in which supposedly in our premise, Dennis was not going to be used because we had a guest singer. So we did the four part of the show, and when the show within our premise was supposedly over, well, then Jack, he came out of the studio and he said, gee, it's such a nice evening. I think I'll just walk home. So he starts to walk home in the dark, and somebody's following him. And every time Jack would walk a little faster, why, this figure would get a little faster. And this went on till finally Jack got home and run in the house. Ross says, boss, what's the matter? He pulled down all the shades and so forth and so on. They called the police. And the police came and they caught the fellow who was following Jack. Well, it turned out to be Dennis. And his excuse was that he was mad because Jack didn't use him on the show that evening. So then we brought Dennis back in the tag, and we had a tag which we threw out, and we're trying to get a different tag. And I got a tag that was, I was so ashamed of, I didn't want to say it, but I figured I'll say it just for the laugh in the room and before people threw things at me, I could get out. But anyway, this was the joke. He said, Jack brought him back, and he says, Dennis, I want to tell you, what you did to me tonight was really, I mean, following me home like that, it gave me an eerie feeling. And Dennis says, gee, Mr. Benny, that's where I was born. He says, oh, Erie, Pennsylvania? He says, no, Feeling, West Virginia. Now, that's pretty bad, I'll tell you. And after I mentioned it working on the script, strangely enough, everybody says, we got to do it. So we did it. And about 6 months later, we did it again. And I think a year or so later, we did it again. And you can always cover those things, you know, because in fact, Jack says, how can you do that same joke so many times? This is easy. You did it once. That's fine. Now, when you do it the second time, half the people didn't hear it the first time anyway. They're all new listeners. Only half of those will remember it, so there's only a quarter of the people who will say, how can you do a joke twice? So that's not bad. And then 6-8 months later, whenever it was, I said, Jack, let's do that same joke again. He looked at me like I was crazy. He says, how can you do that same joke 3 times? I said, you just do it. He says, but everybody now knows it. I said, I know, so we cash in on it. You do the joke, and then you say, Dennis, get out of here. Now you say to the audience, you know, the reason I'm so mad at that kid is because that's the 3rd time he caught me on that same joke. So you admit you've done it before, and at the same, and it always got a big laugh. It didn't make any difference.